It's the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. This is episode 280, Great Debates in Fitness and in Health, number four. It's our fourth debate. Dr. Baraki's on the other end of the line, the second most handsome doctor in North America. What's up, Austin? How you doing, man?
Hey, man, I'm doing okay. I just wrapped up another 2 weeks in the hospital and had a lot of good cases. And interestingly, I was talking to one of my learners, one of my interns who's working on my team this month. And we're talking about strategies for him to improve and ways to learn. And we talked about podcasts as a useful medical education resource. I was like, you listen to any podcasts? He's like, actually in the medicine world, I really only listen to three: Curbsiders, Core IM, which is another internal medicine podcast, and Barbell Medicine.
I was like, oh God. Nice. Nice. Well, I think if you're a medical professional, I think there's some utility to our podcast. If you're listening to it for like the sort of intersection between fitness and medicine, right? Or like maybe practical questions you might have in primary care with relationship to sports medicine, something like that. But if you're looking for like a boards review type podcast, this is probably not it. You know?
Yeah, I agree. We're not covering decompensated cirrhosis here, but we're talking about how to lift, among other things. So,
do you think our listenership would be higher or lower if we just full medicine, all gas, no brakes, just like really keeping up with stuff? I think it would be much lower, but I don't know. We could really niche down on that.
I do think it would be a lot lower. The demographic would shift a little bit, but at the same time, you know, the medical education space, as far as my specialty is concerned, is like, I don't know, it feels a bit saturated out there in terms of the other available content sources. So I don't know why anybody would listen to us over anybody else on those topics. So
we'd have to be more entertaining, I think.
I suppose. I mean, I feel like I'm good at teaching this stuff, as that's been the case historically, but still, you know, there's a lot of good stuff out there for people who want to learn, more niche and details of medicine, but nobody else is really talking about the stuff that we do in many ways.
I know. Yeah. So either not enough people care, and so we're just we're niched down too far, or just have this unique skill set. I prefer to think of it that as the latter, but maybe you guys will let us know in the audience. All right. So we're doing a debate. If you listen to any other great debates that we've done before, the term great is doing a lot of heavy lifting here. It's very charitable.
Mediocre debates.
Yeah. Tepid takes. Right. Yeah. But the reason why we picked this format is because the idea is that if you actually have a decent amount of expertise in an area, then you can anticipate what people who would disagree with you would say. And so by kind of doing both sides of an argument, I think that increases the knowledge that you get from the podcast. Also can be entertaining because it forces us to take some really weird stances that we would not otherwise take. But being able to sort of do the back and forth, I think, is helpful for learning. And just as an aside, a number of the issues that we're going to talk about here don't actually have two real sides to it. I mean, you can make up two sides to any particular argument, but some of them are obviously artificial. And just because there are two sides, that doesn't mean that the real answer actually lies in the middle. One side could be completely, you know, contrarian, but also completely made up. And we'll try to identify that so that you don't think that, oh, maybe there's this like other take out there. Anyway.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I can understand particularly from people maybe used to like debates in the sociological or political realm, that it's like an attractive idea that, you know, overall most things settle somewhere in the middle. And I feel like that is not the case for many of the topics that we'll talk about today. So even though it's attractive to think that, you know, balance and having compromise exactly in the middle of issues is ideal, I don't think that that's accurate or realistic for many things.
Yep, I agree. Okay, so here's the format. Again, this is a loose program. We don't have a moderator. We don't have, you know, we didn't do a ton of direct research on these questions, but we have training in, you know, the subject matter. But the person who goes first is going to have 2 minutes, going to have to pick the affirmative or negative and argue for that. And then there's a 2 minute response, which obviously has the opposite position. And then there'll be a 1 minute rebuttal from the person who started off. It will alternate who goes first. Austin, again, I clearly won the last great debates. I actually think I'm 3-0 by my count.
Oh, are you? Okay, fine.
I think that everybody's been saying that I'm 3-0. So here on the fourth, I will give you the honors to pick your position on this very first question here on Great Debates in Fitness and Health, episode number four. Okay, so the first topic is on Olympic weightlifting and athleticism. Merriam-Webster defines athleticism as, and I quote, the combination of qualities such as speed, strength, and agility that are characteristic of an athlete, where athlete is a person who is trained or skilled in exercise, sports, or games requiring physical development. The debate proposition is as follows. Is Olympic weightlifting the best display of athleticism? Austin, the floor is yours.
Yeah, so off we go with having to take all sorts of ridiculous positions. I'm just going to start off and say no on this one. I don't feel like Olympic weightlifting is the best display of athleticism. The way I'm going to, reason through this is the idea that, you know, per the definition, it's a combination of qualities. In the definition, they cited speed, strength, agility. There's certainly many others that could be folded into a definition of athleticism. And Olympic weightlifting has certain aspects of those physical characteristics, those physical demands, but they're just weighted in a very particular way. We could pick athletes from many other different sports that manifest similar attributes or qualities that are just weighted in a slightly different way. In other words, a 100-meter sprinter or a hurdler, track and field athlete, they have strength, they have speed, they have agility. It's like it's just weighted in a slightly different way. If we go to even different sport, like a team sport sort of thing, or a sport that involves competing against an opponent, you have to deal with not just agility, I suppose, in a snatch relative to a weighted implement that is not going to react against you versus an actual opponent in front of you. And there's going to be a lot of strategy and cognition involved in planning and execution there. So I don't think that there is anything that is a best display of athleticism. I think there are various displays of athleticism that are, you know, weighted for certain qualities or characteristics in different ways. I think Olympic weightlifting is a fine display. It's arguably a very impressive display of athleticism. But, you know, if you take Olympic level, you know, an Olympic weightlifter who has a world record, you know, clean and jerk, and then put them in any field sport or any one-on-one thing where they have to compete against somebody else, they're going to get embarrassed. Of course, that's for a variety of reasons. Most, you know, obviously a lack of practice and development in that sport, but that's just an aspect that is decidedly absent from their primary sport. So weighting things differently, you can choose all sorts of different athletic displays that would, meet great athlete kind of criteria.
All right. So you're forcing me to take the affirmative that Olympic weightlifting is the best display of athleticism. And I think the only way that I can do this, while acknowledging your point that if we consider athleticism, athletes, sports at large, that very clearly you could not make a logical argument that Olympic weightlifting is the overall best display of athleticism. Again, you niche down into these very particular categories, and sure, Olympic weightlifting is a display. However, I think that is engaging in pedantry. People, you're being very pedantic about the definition of the word athlete and athleticism, because I think how it's commonly used refers to, or people conjure up this idea of somebody who's big, strong, fast, sprinting, jumping, whatever. And so I think you could make an argument that if using this sort of common idea of what an athlete is, that Olympic weightlifting is a very good display of athleticism, because you have to engage in all of those commonly conjured up ideas. You have to be strong. You have to be fast. You have to be highly skilled. Again, yes, in a particular sport, sure, I will acknowledge that. But I do think that, general sort of understanding when people say the word athleticism or use that word kind of does conjure up the prototypical Olympic weightlifter in many ways. You can obviously, as you did succinctly, I might add, argue against this being the best display of athleticism. But I think the only way you could make this argument from a place of logic would have to be through some sort of word manipulation. Like, well, and this actually, it kind of goes back to something we talk about at seminars. We used to kind of talk about this sort of, the more athletic that somebody was, maybe the better they would respond to training. That was just an idea we had. It's like, in general, if somebody was more athletic, they'd likely respond to training better than somebody who was less athletic, this sort of training sensitivity being related to maybe somebody's like inherent athletic ability, and that being reliant on genetics and environment, opportunities, all those sort of things. That said, I think you have to expand the definition of what an athlete is to incorporate all organized sports that require some sort of physical development. And if you do that, then very clearly you would have to take the negative in this case. So I have to argue from a place of word manipulation that we and I don't like that stance, but that would be a stance you could use. You get a 1 minute rebuttal.
Yeah, the rebuttal will be straightforward here, because I think you made the claim that Olympic weightlifting fits the general conception of what an athlete is very, very well. And I think if you surveyed the general population of what is the prototypical athlete, nearly 0% of them are going to cite an Olympic weightlifter for that criterion. They're likely going to cite, obviously, somebody with fame and popularity, but it'll be from, in the U.S., it would be, a basketball or NFL player or something like that. If I wanted to just like smooth out globally the average conception of that, of course, soccer or worldwide football being the most popular sport. But I think that to meet all these criteria in a more generally recognized conception, it'd probably be some form of track and field athlete, decathlete competition that would better fit that compared with an Olympic weightlifting.
Yeah, I would say decathlete, but and I don't really get a rebuttal here, but just because I agree, like worldwide, no one's going to pick an Olympic weightlifter outside of maybe two places and various time points.
So like Greece or something.
Greece in like 2000, 2004, somebody might say Kakashvili, or somebody might say Piros Dimas or something like that. Or maybe in China, with the weightlifting sort of infrastructure that they have built there, but certainly not in the United States. People would pick, I think they would pick a sprinter, to be honest, or like a football player, like a skilled position player, like a running back, something like that. Mm-hmm. And they would also be wrong, to be clear. they would also be wrong. It just depends how you're going to test it, And so
exactly. I mean, when you said Olympic weightlifters have to be fast, I'm like, really? Put them on a track. Let's see what happens. It will not go well.
Well, for a 20 meter or 40 meter thing, I think they'd hold their own, pretty well. And if it was a broad jump, I think they could hold their own pretty well. But how are you going to test it? I think you're right though. Decathlete. Maybe that'd probably be my guess.
To the extent that people know what that is. Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. No one's going to pick a decathlete. Okay. All right. Went a little over on that first one, but again, it's a loose program here on the Barbell Medicine podcast. All right. Question number two, this is going to be about low density lipoprotein and should it be lowered early and often? So low density lipoprotein, more commonly known as LDL, shuttles cholesterol around the body. There's mountains of evidence that shows that when LDL is elevated for long periods of time, it increases the risk of heart disease in a dose-dependent manner. LDL can be lowered through diet, exercise, and other lifestyle modifications, as well as through medications like statins. While there is some controversy about a general LDL cholesterol goal for otherwise healthy individuals, most would agree that a target of less than 100 milligrams per deciliter is a reasonable target. Here is the debate proposition. Should individuals without heart disease and with relatively low risk of heart disease target an LDL level of less than 100 milligrams per deciliter using statins or other medications if necessary to achieve that goal? So I will go first, and perhaps surprising to you, I will take the negative on this, that no, people should not target that LDL level if they have to use statins or other medications to get there. So the main reason I'm taking this position is to get Austin to take the affirmative and ultimately provide some high quality information here. But I think if you were arguing against this proposition, you would have to come at it from a position of where the current evidence sort of stands as far as making this intervention early in life and then having long-term outcome outside of very specialized populations like those with familial hypercholesterolemia, those folks who have very high cholesterol levels early on in life. And then when you don't treat that, they have heart attacks and other sort of heart disease issues, complications early on in life. Whereas if you do lower it, well, their risk goes kind of back down in a dose-dependent sort of manner. But outside of that, if you are treating people early on in life with statins to lower their LDL to this particular level or lower, we don't really have good evidence, long-term evidence showing that, people live longer, so their lifespan is longer, their health span is longer, they have less heart disease as they age. That's the sort of predicted response, but I'm going to take the negative just to see what Austin has to say in response to this sort of lack of evidence despite the thought that the cumulative exposure over a lifetime to high levels of LDL is inherently risky with respect to heart disease. So I will take the negative, basically due to lack of data, and I turn it over to you.
Okay. So while in reality, I actually tend to agree with much of what you said in terms of what I would do day-to-day in practice, and I'll come back and touch on that later. being that I am being forced to take the yes position that we should aggressively lower this across the board. The basic argument is that cardiovascular disease is strongly related to this cumulative lifelong exposure to LDL. The higher it is, the longer it's elevated for, the higher somebody's risk is. The cutoff of 100 milligrams per deciliter is arbitrary in many ways. This cumulative exposure is really a gradient. In other words, if it's a lower to, you know, slightly less low to medium to slightly higher to high, it's just a graded effect. And you multiply that degree of elevation times the number of years that somebody has been exposed to it, whether it started when they were a child, an adolescent in their 20s, 30s, 40s, and by decade. And the more years worth of exposure they've had, the higher their risk is. So that's the general framework as it relates to blood lipids. And again, this is the most common cause of death in the US and worldwide. And so we have the potential, by addressing this risk factor, to substantially reduce the degree of morbidity, morbidity referring to the incidence of heart disease, for example, heart attacks, strokes, heart failure, other, you know, cardiovascular complications, and then potentially mortality or the risk of death as well, because many of those sorts of events can be permanently disabling and potentially lethal as well, either directly or indirectly from complications thereof, or leading to hospitalization and complications of that, et cetera, et cetera. So if I look at this purely, you know, I would argue slightly against myself, but very myopically through the lens of just cardiovascular disease burden on the population, the mechanism of how this tends to develop, again, blood lipids being just one among multiple risk factors, and the fact that we have inexpensive, reliable, safe interventions to lower this burden of risk, then the degree of potential benefit exceeds the degree of potential risk. And just purely through a kind of a myopic potential benefit, potential risk calculation applied to the whole population, then yes, you can make the argument that we should, broadly speaking, lower this across the board for all people. I will pause there before rebutting myself to give you an opportunity to do that as well.
Yeah, I mean, the rebuttal would be that from a public health standpoint, I do not disagree and would not rebut that. I would just say that doesn't really interface with the argument as much, given the specific cutoff given here, in which case I would have to say that if, you know, generalized reduction in LDL across the board, sure, I'm on board with that, but lowering it aggressively using medications while having a relatively low risk profile to a very low level, we would say less than 100 in this particular case, again, as you state, is arbitrary and the evidence is lacking in sort of long-term outcomes. And so I stand by my initial point.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if I had to counter that, I mean, the dosage of a medication that would be necessary to take your hypothetical patient, a generally healthy person with a low risk of heart disease, typically their blood lipids are not going to be wildly elevated because they don't have familial hypercholesterolemia. You could literally put them on they could sniff a dose of rosuvastatin. A 2.5 milligram dose of rosuvastatin would probably already be enough to get them below that cutoff if they're generally healthy in all other ways. And the risk of side effects or any kind of adverse effect from that low of a dose is vanishingly low. And so similar, you know, still to the, in that context of deliberately targeting less than 100, it would not take much for your hypothetical patient to get there. And I think that as far as cardiovascular disease risk goes, the potential benefit of that kind of an intervention would probably be greater than the potential risk, although both of those things are low in this situation in absolute terms, right? And so finally, that brings me to like where I would potentially rebut myself, because in practice, if I have a young, completely healthy person whose blood LDL cholesterol level is 105, I'm not starting that person on medications in general, assuming that they don't have other clear risk factors that would jack up their risk, like, oh, every male in my family had a heart attack before they turned 45 or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. For inexplicable reasons, in which case I'd be looking for what's the hidden risk factor that we haven't identified yet that's driving this, maybe a lipoprotein little a level's high or something like that that hasn't been detected. And so, you know, if the aspect that was missing in the original question that I would bring into consideration in practice is patient preferences, values, goals, things like that, right? So when I was alluding to this when I was talking about this question, kind of like a myopically through the lens exclusively of cardiovascular disease, if I'm looking solely at heart disease numbers, potential benefit, potential risk, then yes, the math is pretty clear. But that excludes the fact that there are people on the other side of this who have preferences. Maybe they are, you know, they have no family history of heart disease whatsoever. Maybe they are in every other way perfectly healthy and their blood LDL level, again, is like 108 milligrams per deciliter. And they don't really care to take a medication. They're like, my absolute risk is so low. Taking a pill every day to get a, you know, 20% relative risk reduction from my already very, very low absolute risk is not worth it to me. I don't care. I don't want to do that. In which case, that is part of, you know, evidence-based practice is also incorporating patient values, preferences, and those sorts of things in your decision-making compared with just saying, well, here's an Excel spreadsheet of your risk. Therefore, you must do this. That's not how practice works.
Yeah. I'd also like to, I'm not rebutting anything. I would just like to draw the listener's attention to the fact that at no point did either of us make the case that LDL was not a significant risk factor for heart disease, suggesting that the relationship is just, you know, completely artificial or just correlating, not causative. That is a thought that is out there in the world that people say, oh, LDL doesn't matter. It's actually just a adaptive response to a particular dietary pattern, and it is what it is, like doesn't actually correlate at all. That is not our position.
Also, there are also people who believe that higher is preferable, which, yeah, good luck with that.
yeah, good luck. Okay, want to hear one of my favorite sounds? That's the sound I hear when I get one of my questions right on Babbel. And if you want to learn a new language this year, I guarantee it'll be one of your favorite sounds too. I've been saying I wanted to learn another language for the longest time now, and I'm finally doing it this year with Babbel. I signed up for French because there's a lot of medical history that I'm interested in that was originally written in French. Plus, I've always wanted to travel to France, and when I finally get there, I'd like to be able to get around. Now, Babbel's tips and tools are approachable, accessible, and they're rooted in real-life situations delivered with conversation-based teaching, so you're ready to practice what you've learned in the real world. I actually recorded my first lesson in French. Here, take a listen. Matching au revoir to goodbye.
Au revoir.
Au revoir. When will I get the cool accent?
Bonjour.
All right, got it. Now, that's just my first lesson, so don't judge me or my accent, but I did pick up on a few things that I thought were interesting. There's a lot of spaced repetition and cognitive flexibility being used in their lessons, and I've been pretty impressed so far with the program. The app and regular website are both super easy to use and look great, and the lessons can be done in 10 minutes or less. So far, I feel like I'm learning a lot, and we have a very special deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, babbel.com/barbellpod. That's BABBEL.com/barbellpod. There's rules and restrictions may apply, but 60% off. Check them out, guys. Moving on, question number three. This topic is training style and health. Bodybuilding and powerlifting are both organized sports, where bodybuilding focuses on various qualities of one's physique and powerlifting tests an individual's strength in the squat, bench press, and deadlift. As expected, each discipline has their own training style, where bodybuilding traditionally uses higher rep ranges, lower absolute loads, and more isolation exercises than powerlifting, which tends to feature barbells, heavier loads, and lower rep ranges. The debate proposition is as follows. Is bodybuilding style training better for health than powerlifting? Austin, you get to take the lead on this one.
Okay. I'm going to go with yes on this.
Oh, wow.
I think it is. Yeah. So I'll view this through a few different lenses. And this is admittedly, you know, through what you would consider like a very stereotypical, you know, type of programmer for each of these things. Because what could be powerlifting programming could look like a lot of things, especially if you listen or pay attention to us, where we incorporate a lot of other things because we also take health into consideration and other features. But a more prototypical powerlifting program versus a prototypical bodybuilding style program. So, you know, we know that the physical variables, physical outcomes that we're looking to develop when it comes to health include strength, power, cardiorespiratory fitness. And we also know that when we are dosing our exercise interventions towards those goals, a more potent variable to impact them tends to be overall training volume compared with absolute training intensity. In other words, when we can get people to do higher volumes of training, be it conditioning related, strength training related, we tend to see bigger magnitudes of effect on those outcomes, as well as bigger magnitudes of health improvement. Compared with doing lower volumes but higher intensities, we tend to not see as potent of magnitudes of effect on the outcomes, with a couple caveats relating to, you know, one rep max strength performance and health outcomes. And so if we take the stereotypical bodybuilding program versus the stereotypical powerlifting program, the features that would tend to be different between them is that on the bodybuilding side, it's going to tend to be a bit higher volume. It's going to be tend to be more moderate intensity, I would say on average. It's going to tend to have more exercise variation. And it's going to tend to have more conditioning, particularly for people who want to actually compete in bodybuilding. They have to do conditioning. They frequently do a significant amount of conditioning as part of their training and dieting and attempting to get lean and things like that. Whereas in powerlifting, stereotypical programming, in contrast, is going to be more moderate volume, higher intensity, lower variation, and tend to have less, if any, conditioning in the most stereotyped kind of powerlifting style program. And so I think that there's a significant number of compromises being made on that powerlifting stereotype powerlifting program as it relates to health, because we mentioned that, you know, cranking up intensity does not give you the same magnitude of benefit compared with, increasing training volume for many of these both training related and health related outcomes, be it things like blood pressure lowering, blood sugar lowering, et cetera. The higher degree of intensity, while it does select for more top end strength performance, that really is not really something that is driving a significant degree of health benefit when compared with a bodybuilding program. In other words, people who are doing dedicated bodybuilding programming are not remaining sarcopenic and weak. They're also developing strength, and it's likely to be more than enough to get the health benefits that you can get out of being strong and developing lean body mass. I don't really think that either program is going to be great at developing power, because most of them don't tend to include many high velocity strength components. So we'll call that equivalent. And then the general lack of conditioning on the powerlifting side compared with bodybuilding style training is going to be a significant detriment as it relates to cardiorespiratory fitness. So summarizing, we had strength / lean body mass, power, cardiorespiratory fitness as our outcomes of interest, and multiple variables of bodybuilding style training tend to, I would argue, contribute towards those outcomes a bit better than the stereotypical powerlifting program. And then the final thing that came into my mind is, I seem to recall, you might be able to cite this better than me, but you frequently cite a lot of the injury risk data. And in general, both things tend to be low risk for significant injuries. But I seem to recall you maybe citing that bodybuilding style training had a slightly lower injury incidence per, 1,000 hours, 10,000 hours of participation compared with powerlifting style training. So there may be even a potential lower risk compared to the potential higher benefit there too.
Yeah, I think that's a great argument. And so now I'm forced to say that bodybuilding would not be better than powerlifting. So in this sure. case, would you be okay with me arguing that powerlifting is non-inferior?
Or yeah, do I sure. have to say that power-
yeah. So I acknowledge my colleague's points, and I think he made them well. However, I think I can argue that powerlifting is non-inferior to bodybuilding for health outcomes, and I would use a similar approach, with the caveat being that both programs meet the conditioning guidelines of the physical activity recommendations, and I'll come to that at the end. So from a strength perspective, I would expect powerlifting to improve maximal muscular strength to a greater degree than a stereotypical bodybuilding program. And there may actually be some benefit with respect to health promotion effects. There's some evidence suggesting that those who get stronger, for example, as measured by a 1RM, have a greater degree of blood pressure lowering, for example, and blood glucose control. Now, that is more of an indication of the response to a training program rather than like being stronger in an absolute sense. But if I had to argue this position, which I am, I would say that if anything, powerlifting is going to make you stronger. I think the real take home here is that both are likely going to get you strong enough that you're effectively maxing out health benefits from that perspective, mm-hmm. to not be at risk of not being strong enough to, live a full and complete life from that perspective. With respect to lean body mass, I think, yes, you would have to tip your hat towards a stereotypical bodybuilding program for improving lean body mass better than powerlifting. But again, I think both types of training programs are going to massively, overshoot how much lean body mass you need to actually develop and maintain throughout the life to have the optimal health trajectory from that standpoint. So I don't actually think that's a win for bodybuilding. It's just about the same. You guys are doing enough, as it were. With respect to cardiorespiratory fitness, if we assume that both programs include the minimum amount of conditioning as recommended by the physical activity guidelines, then I think that's a wash. The thing to Austin's point, yes, powerlifters in general do not do as much conditioning as bodybuilders, but there's also this sort of, kind of feeling within bodybuilding to not do a lot of conditioning unless you have to in order to get in stage condition. So the idea is like less is better. And it's weird to me, because that's not like, not doing cardio to me is not a flex. That's like an IQ test. It's like, if you're not doing conditioning because you think, oh, like I don't need to in order to like maintain this particular level of body fat, like, okay, like great, you get a gold star for having great genetics that you get to remain lean. Like, okay, but you're still missing some cardiorespiratory fitness, which we know has a strong impact on health trajectory. So like, I would still do it anyway. There's like people selling programs are like, oh, you don't have to do any cardio on the program to lose fat. And it's like, yeah, I mean, weight management aside, you should still do cardio anyway. It's like better for your health. So non-inferiority. I think I can make the strong case that powerlifting and bodybuilding are equivalent effectively from a health standpoint. My one thing that might tip powerlifting over the edge is I actually think that between the risk of engaging in anabolic steroid use and further potential body image issues, I think those risks are both higher in bodybuilding than powerlifting. Whereas, to your point, I think the injury risk in bodybuilding may be slightly lower than in powerlifting, but I think that is outweighed by the potential use of anabolics and potential body image issue or identifying individuals who are susceptible to developing body image issues. So in that case, I might give the nod to powerlifting, but I think the strongest argument is that it's non-inferior to bodybuilding from health. Thoughts?
Yeah, I think that's a reasonable take. We caveated our answers sufficiently. I think that with your caveat of the powerlifter doing physical activity guideline recommended dosages of conditioning, which is like a rare species out there. I think that if you surveyed the powerlifting population for who's doing at least 150 minutes a week of conditioning, it's going to be very, very tiny. And so, you know, if you want to take that caveat for powerlifting, then I would just take the bodybuilding caveat and say it's going to be, you know, natural bodybuilding. In other words, exclude the PED discussion. And then, yeah, they probably both end up coming out in, you know, if we say natural bodybuilding versus powerlifting with sufficient conditioning, then yes, I'm with you that they're equivalent for health.
Yeah. Unlike, yeah, basically both are so far advanced or in excess of the resistance training guidelines you need to like maximize health.
Yeah.
At that point, it's just for fun.
Yeah, like, exactly.
Enjoyment. Okay. All right. Question number 5 here on episode 280 of the Barbell Medicine podcast. Great debates in fitness and in health with Dr. Austin Baraki. This one is about healthy at every size. The healthy at every size or Hayes approach to public health varies wildly depending on source. At the extreme, some Hayes proponents suggest that weight or body fat levels don't affect health at all outside of weight stigma, whereas more moderate positions hold that folks should focus on healthy behaviors to improve health, with weight loss potentially following the adoption of these healthy behaviors. The debate proposition is as follows. Is the healthy at every size or Hayes movement beneficial for health promotion? So I will, have to take the affirmative position on this. But I'm going to start with the caveat that that the Hayes position cannot deny the health risks of excess adiposity. If that is a caveat I'm allowed to make, then I think the case is quite clear because, you know, this originated back in the 60s, this idea that like, all right, instead of being so weight centric, focused on just weight loss, we need to promote weight loss. The idea was let's promote the healthy behaviors that would result in not only weight loss, but other weight independent health benefits. So for example, we know if people adopt a unprocessed or minimally processed dietary pattern, for example, even if they don't lose weight, that other metrics of health like blood pressure, like cholesterol, like blood sugar management all improve. If they happen to lose weight on top of that, they get a greater improvement. Same thing with exercise. If people start exercising and even if they don't lose weight, a lot of health metrics and proxies for a long-term health trajectory also improve. So there are weight-independent effects on health and weight dependent effects as well on health. And so this sort of movement in its most charitable view is that it's focusing on healthy behaviors rather than just weight. And I think that's overall beneficial. And I think we would both likely outside of a debate sort of scenario be on board with that. I think the issue is with more extreme positions that, you know, outside of the actual stigma towards, you know, people carrying excess body fat, excess body weight, that there is no actual risk of carrying too much body fat, and rather the risk is all reflected by just stigma. And I think that is patently false. Like, you just reams and reams and reams and mountains of evidence show that it's false. And so I would strongly argue against that position and be on good ground to do so. But I do think that focusing on the behaviors and the environment, modifying those to the extent that's possible, would result in improved health and potentially weight loss. And I think that's probably a better way to go than just focusing on weight loss without first focusing on the behaviors that lead to the weight loss.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that the only real way to counter this argument in the contrived debate scenario is to focus on those more extreme positions where folks, you know, will often misinterpret certain forms of evidence or cite data that doesn't necessarily say what they think it does. For example, the easiest one might be looking at just like straight up population level BMI versus health outcome data, right? Where, you know, if you look at the J curve in a cross-sectional analysis of the population, where does the lowest mortality tend to fall on the BMI curve? It's like just slightly into the overweight range. And so they're like, oh, well, BMI is fake news. Nothing about BMI matters. We should ignore this altogether and never measure people's body weight or anything else again. And so I agree that that is an extreme position that is unsupported by data for a whole variety of reasons. And that can definitely lead to harm by dismissing strong evidence of risk factors that we have the potential to intervene upon and substantially reduce the risk of premature disease and death. But to your point, when you were talking about focusing on the behaviors rather than the absolute weight itself, I think that's similar to many other aspects of obesity management. We've talked, for example, about how the individual level combination of their genetic predisposition, their appetite regulation in the food environment that they live in all kind of conspire together to manifest the outcomes of obesity to varying levels across a population. And so if we look at what are the potential targets that we have that we can work on, one is going to be the food environment, which you recently put out an excellent podcast on at the macro scale. And then we have the behaviors of the individual within that environment, which to some extent are under their kind of volitional control. And then the last would be the way that their genetic predisposition sets them up for said behaviors. And that's where some of our more medical interventions have the potential to exert influence. For example, we see that when we initiate patients, for example, on some of the newer medications like the GLP-1 receptor agonists, we see spontaneous behavior change towards the selection of more health promoting foods, less consumption of the unhealthier foods. We see spontaneous uptake of more physical activity and things like that as well. So they effectively function as medications to further augment and support the necessary behavior changes that we're talking about when we talk about healthy at every size type behaviors. And so focusing exclusively on what is the absolute number of kilograms that show up when you stand on a scale is very, very short-sighted in this. And that's also why we've, you know, in some context talked less about obesity as the presence of excess body fat, but rather the underlying mechanisms of appetite dysregulation and the food environment and things like that. So we're actually getting closer and closer to the root causes. So in general, if we qualify, as you did, your argument of excluding the extreme stances that just ignore any role for, you know, body fat in health, then yes, this is a very favorable, beneficial movement for health promotion, destigmatization, and promoting healthy behaviors that can improve health outcomes, regardless of what happens to somebody's weight. But in general, they often tend to spontaneously generate some changes in people's weight. However, those extremes are the best case to argue against this movement of dismissing all of that, ignoring it, and doing nothing about it. Rather, well, I wouldn't even say doing nothing about it, but rather ignoring it from the biomedical lens and targeting those things exclusively from like the sociologic, political, policy level lens to try to, kind of have systematic changes in the acceptance of said things. Rather than recognizing it as something that is potentially intervenable, arguing against whether it should be intervened on at all.
Yeah, I think, taking that stance, rebutting against that stance that the healthy at every size movement has been harmful to public health because in its most extreme iteration is suggesting against, actually intervening upon excess adiposity, excess body fat, because that's not really a problem. I think you would have to provide evidence that this actually has caused harm at either patient level or individual level and or also at a larger community level, meaning that people are not engaging in care that they would otherwise receive for obesity management. Policies are changing or are not changing because of this movement. And I don't think either of those things are true. Mm-hmm. I think if there was substantial evidence to suggest that the Hayes sort of movement is doing that, then you know there'd be a stronger case there against this extreme position. But I think that evidence is lacking. So
yeah,
I see the rest of my time. Dunk. All right, next question. I know that you thought we skipped this, but I didn't. I think this is going to be great. This is on exercise selection.
I was hoping we had skipped it, but here we go. Yeah.
This is on exercise selection. Okay. Exercise selection is defined as the specific activities or movements performed by the individual and their specifics, such as range of motion, tempo, and style. Now, exercise selection is important when it comes to predicting fitness adaptations from the training program. This is best characterized by the specificity of adaptation to imposed demand principle, also known as the SED principle, which suggests that the main adaptations developed from exercise are most specific to the training performed. Now, some have claimed that adopting a low bar back squat style is superior to the high bar back squat because people can often lift more weight with the low bar squat, and it also requires a more horizontal back angle when compared to the high bar squat. The greater weight being used is claimed to drive greater improvements in strength, hypertrophy, and, in some circles, moral superiority, whereas the more horizontal back angle is said to train the back more. The debate proposition is as follows. Austin, is the low bar back squat better for strength, hypertrophy, and health than the high bar back squat?
Okay. So much like you did, I think, in the lipid question earlier, I'm going to adopt the affirmative position here that they are all drastically superior for all those outcomes to allow you to provide some high quality information. So allow me to smooth out my brain a lot here to take this position and deliver this take that the low bar squat is better for all of those outcomes. So the smooth brain take is going to be that strength I'm going to arbitrarily define as the amount of force that somebody produces, which I'm going to exclusively measure by the weight on the bar. I'll allow you to rebut that later. So if somebody is defining strength and measuring it as absolute weight on the bar, in general, on average, most people who train a low bar squat and who also train a high bar squat will tend to be able to lift a bit more weight on the low bar squat compared with the high bar squat. Maybe somewhere on the order of 5, 10, if they're super freaky, maybe like 15% difference. I think that my best difference between the two is somewhere on the order of like 5-ish percent, having trained both of them a fair amount. So more weight on the low bar squat, more force, more strength. Done. next position. It's like comical to take this position, but next is going to be hypertrophy. And so hypertrophy describing the size of the muscle. And so the smooth brain take here is that more weight, more force, more stimulus to the muscle for growth, and therefore it's likely to get bigger and stronger. The other way to come at this argument that I have also heard is that by lifting heavier weights, your muscles will grow to the necessary size to lift said weight. And that's even smoother there. So that's the other position on low bar squatting and hypertrophy. The final one is going to be relating to health. And so this is going to take a rather extreme position that, you know, sarcopenia being a very prevalent problem in terms of how low levels of muscle strength and muscle mass tend to impact health very negatively. And so conversely, the more strength and muscle mass somebody accrues, the more their health, since we said that the low bar squat, you can tend to lift a bit more weight. That means more strength. That means more health. And similarly, when we said it generates more force and more hypertrophy, and similarly, you hypertrophy enough to lift heavier weights, all of that means more muscle mass and more health. I feel absolutely like a clown saying these things, but it will allow you an opportunity to to rebut all of these positions.
I wish that that weren't a real position. Like
in fact real positions.
Wow. Okay. So to rebut, so let's start with strength here. Strength is defined as force production measured in a specific context. So you can test somebody's leg strength, for example, with a squat, a particular type of squat, if you wanted to narrow that down, or you could do it on a leg extension, right? A dynamic movement. It could be an isokinetic, so at the same speed, or isometric type test. It could be on a leg press, you know, but invariably all this is reflecting is that there's some specific context in which you're measuring strength with more or less skill component associated with it, depending on how complicated the movement is. And so with respect to strength trajectory, the low bar back squat is not superior to other types of squats at developing proficiency within that movement. If you had two identical twins on the same exact program, one squatting with a low bar style, the other squatting with a high bar style, you would predict the same relative improvement in their squat strength in that particular style. The high bar squatter would squat more high bar at the end, and the low bar squatter would squat more low bar at the end. And if you tested both of their strengths after 6 months on a leg press, it would be impossible to predict who would do better. Now, I know some people have said, no, the person doing the low bar squat would leg press more for one RM because they were lifting heavier weights. But the ability to lift heavier weights using a particular style is just a function of the mechanical advantage in that particular position. The muscle lengths, for example, and the subsequent mechanical advantage those muscles have in those positions. And that's not even, you know, true across the board. For example, the heaviest squat that's ever been done in the IPF right now was done high bar, Carl Jungvar Christensen, or whatever, you know. And so you could make the argument that, well, the heaviest raw squat was done low bar, and that's Jesus, you know, Oliveira's. But the point is as follows: there's a big style component here. And an interesting thing, you know, if you were just talking about weight on the bar, weight moved, there's two like examples that are, you know, would absolutely be rejected by the folks claiming that low bar squats, you know, make you stronger than high bar squats, make you generally stronger. For example, nobody claims that you should train the sumo deadlift over the conventional deadlift because some people can lift more weight using the sumo style than a conventional. Like nobody makes that argument, even though that's demonstrably true, especially in some weight classes, if you just restrict this analysis to powerlifting. Similarly, no one makes the argument that you should do leg press instead of squats because you can move more weight. There's more weight on the sled than you could ever load on the barbell. And it's just, well, no, it's just the muscles producing more force. And if you make the muscles be able to produce more force in one particular context, then in all contexts, they're going to be stronger. That is definitively not the case. This has been tested a number of times. And so, you know, whatever, it's a crapshoot. As far as how things transfer to other tasks, other tests of strength, the more similar the one movement is to another, the more carryover you would expect. You would predict. That's a fine heuristic. Again, individuals will vary, but the idea that low bar back squat develops general strength better than any other type of squat remains to be proven. Remains to be proven. And again, there's going to be inter-individual variation in there that is significant enough, I think, to make this argument on shaky ground at best, but to what you said earlier, a very smooth brain take based on not only the available evidence, but also just experience, right? So, okay, with respect to hypertrophy, the idea that lifting a heavier weight in any particular context generates more hypertrophy than lifting a lighter weight is demonstrably false based on available evidence. We know that blood flow restriction training, for example, generates the similar hypertrophy responses to regular traditional resistance training, and they're using 30% of the 1RM in blood flow restriction training. We know that training with lighter weights, when you get close to failure, produce the same sort of hypertrophy response as lifting heavier weights close to failure. And everything in between, even leg extensions, a much lighter exercise than squats, produce on average more hypertrophy of the quadriceps than squats. And so the idea that you got to lift heavier weights to get stronger, it's like, no, you get to lift heavier weights because you do get stronger. And you just have to lift that more challenging load now to get closer to failure to generate the hypertrophy response. But exercise selection, there are a number of exercises that you can choose, some lighter, some heavier, that ultimately improve muscular hypertrophy. And finally, with respect to health, doing either type of squat, any type of squat, is for a long enough period of time in a way that makes you stronger than when you started, makes your muscles grow. So meaning the training stimulus overall is adequate, and that could be high bar, could be low bar, could be front squat, could be whatever, Zercher squat, safety squat bar, duffel, like pick your squat, leg press even. Those are going to all far exceed how strong, how muscular you need to get to maximize health trajectory. So the idea that low bar squat is better for health than high bar squat, it's like, guys, if you're squatting over body weight for reps on the bar, like body weight on the bar for reps, you are strong enough to sort of maximize health trajectory from just a strength perspective. Is it cool to get stronger? Well, if you want to, sure. Like I do. We're part of that group. But I can't make the argument that squatting, achieving a double body weight squat, is going to significantly improve your health span or lifespan compared to squatting 1.5 times body weight. And so you should adopt this particular style that allows you to generate a twice body weight squat. And finally, some anecdotal evidence, which should be the lowest, rung on this hierarchy of evidence. My best high bar squat and best low bar squat, with knee wraps, mind you, are the exact same. they're the exact same, 640 pounds. And so that's one data point, but the difference just isn't big enough to matter. And so my practical take home before you rebut my stance, Dr. Baraki, is that it doesn't matter enough to make a big enough difference to care about. You want a low bar squat? Great. If you want a high bar squat? Great. You want a front squat? Great. I'm just happy that you're squatting. But to select one over the other based on these sort of purported benefits that remain yet to be seen, don't know. Don't know. So, Austin, you're free to rebut this.
Yeah, there's no rebuttal here. That's done.
You just see the rest of time.
Yes, exactly.
Absolutely. Yeah, imagine, you know, this whole thing is like you have to do this low bar squat because you're going to lift a slightly more weight through a constrained range of motion, a contrived range of motion even, like, okay, just a half an inch below parallel. We're just picking that up out of nowhere. And that's going to transfer universally the best to every other sort of test or task involving low body strength. It's like, that is a preposterous position to hold. And I don't know how you do it with a straight face. Okay. All right. We'll just moving on. And to be clear, it is okay to have that be your initial position. But as you go get further experienced and you kind of get exposed to more and more evidence and you kind of refine your thinking, it's also okay to change your mind. Your mind should change as the facts change. And if that doesn't happen, well, that's a problem. Okay. All right, that is a wrap on Great Debates in Fitness and in Health, episode number 4. Special shout out to Dr. Austin Baraki for making time out of his schedule to join me on the podcast. Thank you for listening to the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. Again, I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. Before you guys go anywhere, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps drive traffic to our podcast so we can keep bringing you all this nuance and fitness from everyone here at Barbell Medicine. We'll catch you next time on the Barbell Medicine Podcast.